Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lost amid the weekend's noise and news was President Trump's first big move to recast the American economy when Wall Street plunged the country into crisis and recession in 2008. Congress and the White House laid down the Dodd-Frank rules and more to tighten up banking, to rein in risk and protect the little gal and guy. Those rules made life tougher for bankers. The debate now is whether the new president will loosen them for the better or take us back to the bad old days. This hour on Point in our 100-day spotlight on the Trump administration, the president's plans to roll back banking laws and rules. You can join us on air or online. But this conversation is always on. What do you hope for or fear in the president's new push? Has Dodd-Frank been a choke chain on your business? And who are these changes for? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was President Trump last week before signing his executive order to take apart as much as he can the Dodd-Frank package.
Dodd-Frank is a disaster. We're going to be doing a big number of Dodd-Frank. So that's one big reason why I'm taking this action, and I'll be taking an action later this morning. If you'd like, you can join me at the signing to begin our effort to dramatically reduce federal regulations, and we'll be reducing them big league and their damaging effects on our small businesses, our economy, our entrepreneurial spirit.
Okay, so what's coming? Joining me now from Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, is Steve Leisman, senior economics reporter for CNBC, former senior economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Steve Leisman, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, all right. Donald Trump was extremely critical of Wall Street on the campaign trail. We'll hear some of that in this hour. Now he's looking to loosen the reins on American banking. What kind of steps is he prepared to push for, Steve?
Well, that's what we're kind of bracing for right now. Interestingly enough, the executive order that he signed did not, strictly speaking, mention Dodd-Frank. It's called the Core Principles for Regulating the United States Financial System. I think the theory of the case as put forward by the president is that the rules that have been promulgated since the financial crisis are too onerous on banks. They keep capital levels too high. And what I mean by that is they require the banks to put too much money aside, essentially the banks keeping money in the bank relative to the number of loans they have out there. And if they can loosen up those regulations, loosen up the capital levels, then there's more money to spend and more money to lend out there, and that this could essentially juice the economy and bring up economic growth levels. Whether or not that's true is a matter of debate. Some people have looked at the lending levels that are out there and said, you know what, they're growing 7% a year for the past several years, so it doesn't look a whole lot like Dodd-Frank's really got in the way of lending. But be that as it may, that's the president's case, that if you loosen up regulations on the banks, there's more money to lend. More money to lend means more economic growth.
So let's just look at that for starters, because, of course, that factor, how leveraged the banks were, was a big part of what blew up back in 2007, 2000. I mean, Lehman Brothers had a debt-to-equity ratio of 60-1. Now, I mean, banks are being herded towards something more like 10-1. You know, for every dollar of equity, they have $10 of debt. So if we go back toward the Lehman Brothers end of the spectrum, does that put us at risk again of another meltdown?
Well, you got it. I mean, you put your finger on the debate right there. And if I could, there's two pieces of that debate. One is the general level of capital for banks. And the second is whether the biggest banks should pay a certain surcharge or have a even higher capital level because they're big. The reasoning behind this is that a big bank, kind of like the 800-pound gorilla in the room, will never take account for the risk that they create to the broader financial system. So the idea is to have a special surcharge on the big banks so that they pay for, and by the way, limit their size. The way I think about
this, we did bail a bunch of them out after the meltdown. So it's not as though we don't have an interest in them being really cautious there.
We sure do. And that's really the issue of whether or not we can design a system that makes sure we never have to bail out a bank again through taxpayer bailouts. But let me give you a way to think about this, Tom, is if you don't get in your car and drive, you have no chance of an accident.
Mm-hmm.
If you get in your Maserati and you drive 100 miles an hour down a winding country road,
yep,
you're very serious chance of an accident. So getting that speed limit right relative to all possible roads ahead is the philosophical debate around what the right capital level is. I think there may be an argument that maybe they went a little bit too far. Sometimes the pendulum swings in a post-crisis area, in a post-crisis era, where it gets too strong or too strenuous. But the idea of going back to where we were before, well, I think you just nailed it. That would create all that risk that created the financial crisis all over again.
Who's this really for, Steve? Donald Trump was so hard on Wall Street on the campaign trail. I mean, you said again and again that Hillary Clinton was all tied up with them. That she was in the pocket of Goldman Sachs, and now he's got Goldman Sachs guys, as you well know, driving so much of this change for him. And he talked a lot about, bringing the economy back, not literally in Wall Street, but around the country. Is this for Wall Street? Is it for Main Street bankers? Where is it really aimed?
Well, I mean, you know, you could take the president at his word and say it's about economic growth and saying about getting loans to small businesses and getting loans to average Americans. Or you can take a look at the people around him and say the people who are advising him are the ones who have the most to gain by loosening up these regulations. What is interesting is that bank profitability has come back. I mean, you do want in a country – in an economy, you want a profitable banking sector that's well cushioned against possible losses. We are there now, and the banking sector looks pretty profitable. On the other hand, Tom, you have to look at a law that created hundreds of rules, thousands of pages of regulation that really does cost a lot of banks a lot of money in order to enforce. And maybe one of the places we could start is the regulations that govern the smaller banks. In fact, last year, it looked like the Senate, which is where a lot of this, by the way, drama is going to play out, was very close to passing a rule that would have raised the level at which these most onerous regulations affect the smaller community banks. And that seems to be something where there seems to be agreement between Democrats and Republicans, which is that the smallest banks don't have to follow the harshest rules compared to the bigger banks because they represent less risk to the system.
But is that really where the weight of this appears to be headed? I mean, what I'm reading about here is the administration looking to target a ban on proprietary trading. That sounds like a real Wall Street thing, not Main Street. Taking down the rules or going after the rules for taking down failed banks so it's more orderly and doesn't put the economy at risk. Well,
right.
A Main Street bank is not going to take the economy down. That's Wall Street again. It sounds like this is the architecture around the biggest banks, the banks that got us in trouble, Steve.
Some of it is. Now, you're talking to a guy who covered this whole creation of this rule, of this law and the regulations.
That is
and
you.
And there were moments that I, you know, wanted to jump off a cliff because it's so full of sort of financial arcana and all of these and bureaucratic abbreviations and stuff like that.
Yeah, well,
here's an example of this derivatives rule what's called the Volcker rule after the former Fed chairman Paul Volcker, which says the banks can't trade for their accounts, and the concept makes a lot of sense. And that says, you know what, if you have a taxpayer backup, which is essentially the FDIC, then you shouldn't be playing around with your money that the taxpayers may have to bail out. Makes a lot of sense, okay? The trouble is that the implementation of this rule and creation of this rule has been so ridiculously cumbersome. They really have not come up with a way to limit it. Plus, as bad as that sounds, this idea of trading for the prop accounts, it's hard to draw a line from the financial crisis to this thing, so to the prop trading. So rolling that back, it sounds like it's a really bad thing. I'm personally not sure it is.
And then you get into the stuff that's not exactly Dodd-Frank, though it's all being kind of lumped together these days, but changing the leadership of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Richard Cordray's been there. He's been seen as a real champion for the little guy.
Right.
Now they want to change the structure so that instead of one person in charge, which can be pretty effective action if you like that person, they'll have five people. And, of course, then it gets political who names what and slows it all down. Why do that?
So this is where you get into areas where it looks like he is really benefiting the banking system at the expense of individual average Americans and individual investors. There's a couple rules that are out there. First is this Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which the Republicans absolutely hate. They hate the idea that it has autonomy and independence that is essentially outside of congressional review. They really dislike that. They dislike the idea
that lobbyists hate it because they can't lobby Congress people to go in and gut it.
You got it. They really hate this. It's created a lot of paperwork for the banks. Meanwhile, what it does is it essentially is the ombudsman for consumers out there when it comes to financial and regulatory products. And God knows we could all use more help and someone on our side when it comes to signing the mortgage documents. To which, by the way, I give the banking side on this. They say, you know, what it's done is it's made mortgages more cumbersome to sign because it's created more paperwork. But there are cases like, for example, the Wells Fargo case, which the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau really brought to light, which is that they were creating fake accounts for some of their customers.
Pretty outrageous.
It was It was pretty outrageous. And the other one where it looks like they're really siding with Wall Street is this notion of whether or not your financial advisor has to act in your interest or in their own interest.
The so-called fiduciary rule. And they want to get rid of that.
You got it. You got it. And that's one where they say, you know what? That limits the choice of investors. I am really having a hard time getting my brain around what is wrong with this rule and the notion that you are forcing financial advisors to act in the interest of their clients. But this one where they've sold it essentially as one that says this is going to increase the choice of investors and decrease the cost.
I mean, those advisors will make billions less a year with the fiduciary rule. The Obama administration got this in there.
Right.
It hasn't even taken effect yet, right? But it would never if Trump has its way. Can you really be on the side of the little guy and be against a fiduciary rule?
So like I said, Tom, I have an easier time getting my brain around amendments and reforms to the broader Dodd-Frank capital rules than I do these. These ones that, first of all, I think it's politically horrible for the Trump administration to be, out in front of these rules, which make it seem like at least they're favoring the banks as opposed to the individual investors and average Americans. On the other hand, it's really hard for me to figure out why this is better for the economy and better for individual investors.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's moves to undo Dodd-Frank and the banking regulation that came after the crash and crisis of 08. He wants to loosen up. We're looking at the implications of that. Steve Leisman is with us, senior economics reporter for CNBC. Diana Furcott-Roth and Jared Bernstein join us in just a moment. You can join us as well this hour. What do you think? Should the steps put in place to secure the economy after 2008 be carved back? Does that set the economy free or put us back in peril? And if the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is weakened, does that make the little guy safer? If your financial advisor doesn't have to give you advice that's in your best interest, does that make the little guy and gal safer? On the campaign trail, Donald Trump was really tough sounding on Wall Street. Made it sound like Wall Street big banks were the problem, not the solution for the average American's economic woes. Probably one of the keys to his voter support was his repeated promise that he and not Hillary Clinton could tell Wall Street where to go. Here he was in Ottumwa, Iowa, last August.
I'm not going to let Wall Street get away with murder. Wall Street has caused tremendous problems for us. We're going to tax Wall Street. We're going to get rid of certain things that they should have. I've been talking about it very strongly. Certain things that they want. And they want them badly, and it's not fair to give it to them. And I'm going to, because I don't care about the Wall Street guys, but you know why? Because I'm not taking any of their money.
Okay, that was Donald Trump last summer. Here he was last Friday signing this executive order that starts the clock on dismantling financial regulations.
We expect to be cutting a lot out of Dodd-Frank because, frankly, I have so many people, friends of mine, that have nice businesses. They can't borrow money. They just can't get any money because the banks just won't let them borrow.
Okay, friends of mine, Steve Leisman, they can't get money because, nice businesses, the banks won't let them borrow. Has borrowing been tough for businesses, American businesses?
So if I could just address that first quote, which I'm trying to get my brain around, because my guess is the friends of Donald Trump have had a very easy time of getting loans. If anything has been wrong with the lending system in the post-financial crisis era, it's that banks are taking less risk and less likely to give loans to people who are further down either the income scale or the creditworthy scale. So it struck me that those friends of Donald Trump that can't get loans—
Probably doing fine,
must have,
the ones who come to Mar-a-Lago.
Right. They must have some really crazy, unbankable ideas that make it so that they cannot get loans. So the data show that commercial bank lending has been growing about 7% a year. And another interesting statistic comes from the national the NFIB, which is a small business group, and they show only 4% of their members say they've had trouble getting credit. The biggest problem that we think is out there when it comes to lending in America is a lack of demand. And you do not see huge demand for loans, and you do not see many people being turned down for their loans. So it's a little hard to see exactly what the problem is, other than what I said earlier, which is the paperwork and the cost of complying with the rules.
Well, maybe the Trump idea is here, you know, sort of loosen it up, get things a little loose, and pretty soon the economy crackles.
Like I said, you can definitely run the economy at— You know, you can run it hotter. You can run it with more risk, and you can probably get some more growth out there. But the question becomes the issue of balance, balancing risk against the benefits that you get from it. And I think we found that running it too hot with too much risk can create tremendous financial dislocation. And you know, anytime the Fed chair, Janet Yellen, is asked about the costs of the current regulation, she says, well, just look at the financial crisis. Millions lost their job.
True.
GDP plunged at the greatest rate of the post-war depression era.
True.
So that's what she says is the cost of not having the regs right.
A couple calls here. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
If Dodd-Frank is repealed, should I no longer be trusting my financial advisor to manage my retirement account because we no longer have a fiduciary arrangement?
Fiduciary responsibility there. Steve, what about it?
So I'm no expert on personal finances, but I will say this. What you're going to want to do is ask your financial advisor very carefully about the costs associated with a specific investment vehicle that he's putting you in relative to the costs of others.
Because currently they're not obligated to put your interest absolutely first. They can take their own profit into account.
Exactly. It's a bit, by the way, like the real estate business where the real estate broker showing you your home, your next home, is working on behalf of the buyer. In this case, you can certainly ask your financial advisor, how much are you making off of this? Is there any kind of special that you're getting? Because sometimes they run essentially specials that say if the financial advisors place this mutual fund over the next 6 months or so or year, then they'll get X commission. And you can ask your financial advisor. I'm saying don't not trust them. I think a lot of financial advisors, regardless of what the law is, have the interest of their clients at heart. I think that's probably the case with the majority of financial advisors. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't ask questions and be very clear about what he's charging you, what he's making off of that, and whether or not there are less costly alternatives for you.
I mean, to be clear, this fiduciary rule that would have required them to put your interest first, that was put through during the Obama administration, that hasn't even taken effect yet, right? And what Trump would do would stop it before it ever would take effect. You know, advisors are saying, well, we can't tell you all the options. If you're held to this rule, it constrains ultimately the consumer's options. But there's a lot of fire out there about this. Jim, be careful. Be careful. Kim in Providence, Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Okay. What do you see, Kim?
It's just very disingenuous of Trump to be labeling this as a profit for small businesses when it just seems so obvious that the people who are going to gain the most is big business and the banks. And the propaganda of just keeping to say that it's, you know, going to be profiting small business and, you know, the sort of American work ethic is, it just doesn't fall very genuine on my ears. And lumping it in with all of the, you know, the sort of view that regulation in general is bad and it's all big government is scary. You know, when you think about all the deregulation he's going to do with the EPA in terms of that, too.
And there's a bigger picture here, but the finance picture is pretty big all on its own, as you say, Kim. I mean, 08 and the Great Recession were pretty painful. We don't want to go there again. I mean, Steve, what about what did happen to the bonuses and all that on Wall Street after Dodd-Frank kicked in to their money train?
So they've come down a bit, but also there were some rules put in place that allowed some of the bonuses to be clawed back if in the future after something that somebody got rewarded for, if some of those investments or ideas or decisions went bad. But Wall Street's still doing pretty well based upon how well they're doing in their earnings. I will point out now, if I could just take a sort of centrist view on this, that that it's hubris to say they got it absolutely right the first time. I think both Democrats and even supporters of Dodd-Frank and Republicans would say, you know what, we can amend this at the margin to make it marginally more favorable.
I mean, Barney Frank himself is saying that, Frank of Dodd-Frank, Barney Frank.
Exactly. And by the way, I have to say, if you read the president's executive order, it reads very differently from the rhetoric when he gets up and says, we're going to change Dodd-Frank big league, we're going to be cutting a lot out of it. It's a measured executive order in which, by the way, he tasks the Treasury Secretary to consult with the agencies who currently implement this and report back to him in 120 days. What's interesting about that aspect politically is that all of the people he's consulting with, or at least most of them, are essentially Obama administration appointees. So at least over that period of time, the consultation that will be given will be consultation generally in favor of the broad outlines of Dodd-Frank.
Though, I mean, to be fair, that Treasury Secretary, if he has his way and he's confirmed, will be Steven Mnuchin, who is a partner at Goldman Sachs. And as of course, as you well know, the guy who's really driving all this in the White House is Gary Cohn, now director of the National Economic Council under Donald Trump, named there, who was number two at Goldman Sachs. So it's not as if it doesn't have Wall Street, Goldman Sachs right on the button, Steve.
He has an awful lot of advice from Wall Street. He also has the ear of or Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan. Look, these guys, I think, do not want to see the banking system get back into the place that it was. None of them want to go there. And I think all of them, Gary Cohn, Steve Mnuchin, and Jamie Dimon are less inclined to see a race to the bottom than it sounds like when you listen to what Donald Trump wants to do to Dodd-Frank. And by the way, one of the interesting parts about this is one of the good things about Dodd-Frank for these big banks is it keeps out competition. And in fact, they have indeed gotten bigger during the time of Dodd-Frank, because the cost of these regulations make it harder for smaller banks to compete. So one of the things I think you'll see is some moderation as to how much Dodd-Frank is reformed coming from the consultation of those people you mentioned.
Let's get a couple of views on this. Steve Leisman with CNBC. Please stand by. Really glad you're here. Diana Ferscott-Roth joins us now from Washington, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She served as a campaign advisor and member of the transition team for President Donald Trump, now president, associate director of the Office of Policy Planning in the White House under George H.W. Bush, the president. Diana Ferscott-Roth, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
And Jared Bernstein is with us from Alexandria, Virginia, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Jared Bernstein, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Diana, what do you see as the intention and the likely outcome of this push by the president, the executive order on Friday?
Well, the intention is to signal that he is going to fulfill his campaign promise to redo Dodd-Frank. That, of course, requires congressional legislation because Dodd-Frank was passed by Congress. But there are a certain number of regulations that the Treasury and the Securities and Exchange Commission could modify on their own. So I think what he wanted to do was not say, here's how I'm altering Dodd-Frank, but say, I'm fulfilling my campaign promise. I'm going to take a major look at this, the same as he did with the fiduciary rule. It was a signal. It was a memo to the Labor Department to look at the rule.
So can you, as the president says, do a number on Dodd-Frank and protect, support the little guy? Or is this about cutting Wall Street loose to, make a zillion bucks and devil take the hindmost?
Well, it's important to look at what Dodd-Frank was supposed to do. It was supposed to get rid of the risk, lower the risk of bank failure.
Which seemed like a good idea at the time, right? I mean,
it's certainly a good idea. The question is it accomplishing what it set out to do? There are three major problems with it. First, its standards and rules require regulatory enforcement. Instead of giving bankers strong incentives to maintain safety and soundness in their own institutions. Second, the regulatory framework attempts to prevent any individual bank from failing, rather than preventing the collapse of the payments and credit systems. And third, there isn't any attempt in Dodd-Frank to address the key problem of government subsidization of mortgage risk and the exposures of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So I think that it's not a question of getting rid of regulation, but modifying regulation to better direct it at the causes that it was supposed to address to begin with.
Why put the fiduciary rule back on the table? It just sounds like a big, fat, juicy gift to financial advisors at the expense of the consumer or the small investor.
The fiduciary rule is completely separate from Dodd-Frank, and actually I would beg to differ. What the fiduciary rule did was make it practically impossible to have commission-based financial advice. It was possible to pay up front for a wealth advisor, and those advisors did not have to meet the criterion of acting in people's best interests. But it was very difficult to go to a financial advisor, get him to invest funds, and pay a small percentage of him in an ongoing way, as millions of people do. Mm. Now, there are many people who cannot afford to pay up front for financial advice, and taking away this method of investing that many, many middle-class people use was really a travesty. And as far as the best interest goes, it's very difficult to deem what is in someone's best interests because they have different preference for risk. Some people might prefer to be 100% in stocks. So can they sue their financial advisor when the stock market goes down? Possibly under the rule, because they could say, well, it wasn't in my best interest to be 100% in stocks. So I think the fiduciary rule really needed to be revoked, rescinded, and President Trump is sending a signal that this is what he's going to do by issuing this memo to the Labor Department and asking the Labor Department to look at the matter. It's supposed to take effect in April, so it's important that he sent this signal because otherwise insurance brokers and stockbrokers would have to jump through hoops, pay to comply with it, even when it is not going to happen.
Jared Bernstein, jump in here on the fiduciary rule and beyond. Start there if you like, and then the big picture of what's being pushed for here and its implications.
Sure. What Diana was describing is nothing like what the fiduciary rule would actually do. And in fact, it's very clear in this rule that if you go to your financial advisor and that advisor is following this rule, that means that his or her conflicts of interest are diminished. And you tell them, I want an actively managed fund, I want to be 100% in stocks, they can absolutely put you there because that's in your interest, that's your preference, and if you blow it and the stock market goes down, that's your problem, not theirs. I mean, that's clearly articulated in the rule, so Diana's just wrong about that. Look, this is a rule that's been a long time coming, and I think what's so interesting about it is that there are a number of big banks, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, some other banks that are saying, we're going to do this anyway, whether the Trump team blocks the rule or not, because we think that our clients are better off if we're not paying our brokers conflicted compensation.
They're going to stick with the fiduciary rule. What about the bigger picture of the impact, implications of the executive order on Friday, Jared?
Well, the executive order is probably, I guess I view it as less benign than I think Diana and maybe even Steve do, in the sense that I don't think it's just a matter of you know, hey, let's just take a look at this and see, you know, how we feel about it. If you listen to things that Gary Cohn said, Donald Trump said, Steve Mnuchin said, it's not just that there are burdensome aspects of Dodd-Frank, which there are, especially compliance for smaller institutions. It's that they believe that this is crimping the earning power of the big banks, primarily through the thing that you and Steve were talking about, the fact that banks have to hold a larger capital buffer. That means they can't leverage up as much and kind of goose their profits the way they were. At the same time, that makes them less risky, which, of course, is the point of the rule. So I think what they're trying to do is thwart the regulation so that banks can get their risk on in a way that they were kind of doing back in the go-go 2000s, and you know that ended very badly.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's moves to undo Dodd-Frank, do a big number on it, he says, and the banking regulation that came after the crash and crisis of 08. He wants to loosen up again. We're looking at the implications of that, where the benefits of this change, whatever comes, might fall, where the costs might fall. Diana Furscott-Roth is with us from the Manhattan Institute. She was on the transition team for President Donald Trump. Jared Bernstein is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Steve Leisman is here from CNBC, senior economics reporter there. And you can join us. Has Dodd-Frank crimped your style in business, in banking? And who's the big winner if we loosen up? Main Street? Wall Street? You? Can we ease the rules on the U.S. economy and avoid the next crash? Really look out for the little guy and gal. Again, here was the now president, then candidate Donald Trump, a campaign rally in Manheim, Pennsylvania last fall. His message to working class voters, Wall Street is ruining you and I'll stand up to them.
Just picture a Wall Street boardroom filled with special interests who've been bleeding our country, who've been bleeding Pennsylvania, who've been taking your jobs. Take a look on their faces and you will see smart people that know the game, but people that want to take your jobs and want to take your money. To them, I say you're fired.
Wall Street, the bad guy in Donald Trump's campaign season. Here was White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer last Friday slamming the Dodd-Frank Act that reins Wall Street in.
The Dodd-Frank Act is a disastrous policy that's hindering our markets, reducing the availability of credit, and crippling our economy's ability to grow and create jobs.
Democrats all over it. Here's House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
The president has moved to expose hardworking Americans to unfair, deceptive, and predatory practices, perpetuating a massive con on those who thought he would stand up for them against the powerful interest.
And Democrat Maxine Waters.
These directives show once and for all that when push comes to shove, Donald Trump will always put the interests of his pals on Wall Street over the interests of the American people.
So here we are, a couple of calls, and I'll come to my guests, Elizabeth in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Elizabeth, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Contrary to what Trump says, we need more regulation on blood-sucking practices by banks, not less. And that was explained so well in The Big Short. However, Dodd-Frank hasn't done that, as we saw in the Wells Fargo example. What Dodd-Frank has done, in fact, is it's a fig leaf, and it's used as an excuse by banks to make it harder for individuals to get a loan.
Why would they want to have an excuse? Why wouldn't they want a loan, Elizabeth? Why wouldn't they want to loan if they can make a, you know, make a good deal?
I think it's a show. They're trying to act like they're being subjected to more restrictions now. When I tried to refinance my mortgage, it was a combination of the Spanish Inquisition and an avalanche of paperwork. And I think that is just their attempt at appearing to be subject to more regulation, when in fact they are not.
Steve Leisman, can you pick that up? I mean, how much of that these days goes back to Dodd-Frank? Are the banks exercising it in a sort of straight-up way? Would they have a reason to hide behind it or use it as an excuse to crimp lending?
Yeah, I'm afraid the caller just spoke in favor of Dodd-Frank reform. A lot of the paperwork seems to be something that's happened after Dodd-Frank in order to increase disclosure and stop the kind of fraud that happened before the financial crisis, where people who were
subprime
and that all bit of nasty lending that went on. I've also done some research, and what I did find is that the percentage of loans that are given, sort of mortgages given to those down the credit spectrum, those with the lower FICO scores, has gone down. It's practically crashed to the point where it looks like the banks are not taking normal risk. And like I said, between the idea of scrapping Dodd-Frank and keeping it as it is, it strikes me as there's a middle ground here that loosens it up a bit so that banks take a bit more risk and are able to give loans a little bit further down the credit spectrum to those Americans that can't get them.
Jared Bernstein, is it time to loosen up a little bit here so that banks can take what Steve calls normal risk?
I think in the mortgage space, it really is. I think that it's easy to conflate Dodd-Frank and other sets of rules that have been promulgated around the mortgage institutions, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, but they're actually different. And on the mortgage side, I think there are still some log jams there, such that creditworthy borrowers with decent FICO scores aren't able to get the kinds of home loans that they should. Dodd-Frank doesn't really speak to that. Dodd-Frank is much more about banks making loans to investors. It's about derivatives, the type of loans that I think Warren Buffett called some sort of weapons of mass destruction in financial markets. And it's done a very nice job of taming that part of the market. So I think you actually have to be careful not to conflate those two sides of the lending structure.
Diane, I heard you there, Diane.
Dodd-Frank, I think that your listener should be honored that she shares the same problem as Ben Bernanke when he left the Federal Reserve.
Meaning?
He famously was not able to refinance his house because he did not have a job. And under Dodd-Frank, the bank has to make sure that the borrower can repay. He, although he would be having millions of dollars in income, could not show that. So she is in very good company, and these rules need to be modified. But I think that we're not so much talking about throwing out Dodd-Frank and leaving banks with nothing. There are many proposals to improve on Dodd-Frank. For example, requiring large, important banks to increase their capacity to deal with losses, raise the minimum ratio of the book value of their equity relative to the book value of their assets. And the Brown-Vitta bill proposed to raise that minimum ratio to 15%, about a threefold increase from current levels. And this is something that would perhaps do away with a lot of the regulations, but place banks in a stronger position than they were before. Also to require them to maintain cash reserves. During the Great Depression, New York City banks maintained cash reserves in excess of 25%. And it's not clear 25% is the right level, but they should be required to have clear cash reserves. But there are a lot of facets of Dodd-Frank that don't seem to have anything to do with this. For example, the requirement on the front page of Section B of the Wall Street Journal that companies disclose the ratio of the pay of chief executives and the median worker, which the SEC is looking at rolling back. There's no reason that a CEO's pay should be linked to that of the median worker in the company. It costs companies to comply. It doesn't benefit anybody. There are many rules like that that could be rolled back and instead put in simple regulations about cash reserves that have to be maintained and minimum ratios of book value to equity.
I mean, Steve, maybe that does sound like, from a certain perspective, that could be a stretch. On the other hand, we saw Wall Street compensation get so huge that enormous risks looked worthwhile to people. And, you know, on the downside, as we heard for years, nobody went to prison here. On the upside, it seems so out of whack that people might put the whole economy in peril because the payouts could be so gigantic, Steve.
I think that's right. What interests me about this is when I look at the differentials between CEO pay and average pay, it strikes me that somewhere in there is what economists call a market failure, the inability of the market to correctly, you know, arbitrage that differential. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that what the Obama administration did was something that falls short of regulating the differential, but deciding that exposing and being transparent about the differential and making that information known to both the public and especially, by the way, to shareholders is something that could help the market regulate itself.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely clear to me why there should be so much opposition to the disclosure of the information. Look, if you're not proud about it, don't do it. But make it. But if you disclose it, let the market arbitrage it.
It has nothing to do with controlling bank risk taking.
I agree with Steve on this point because I think that one of the problems here, and we shouldn't let this get lost, is that these folks were bailed out at taxpayer expense.
Yep.
And if we go down this road again, there's no reason why that wouldn't happen. And in fact, one of the purposes of Dodd-Frank is precisely to try to avoid that kind of outcome. You know, we were talking about this Volcker rule earlier. So that's a rule that says if you're a bank that's insured by the FDIC, meaning you're ultimately backed by taxpayers, you can't put that kind of privilege at risk, such that taxpayers would have to jump in and bail you out if you, you know, once again blow up the economy. And the folks who got slammed by this and people who are still trying to climb out of the hole are not the banking community. They've been doing really pretty well, which is another reason why it makes it kind of hard to argue that Dodd-Frank has been such a disaster for them. They've certainly been doing better than the median household. So I think that kind of transparency is a sunlight that's very much warranted.
Let's go to Joe
it's
in New York.
It's not just for banks. It's for other companies also. It doesn't have anything to do with the fundamental
The banks were the ones who bailed out.
Yeah, Joe in New York City. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Fantastic show. It's taken 50 minutes of the program to get to something that Americans desperately are seeking, which is transparency and fairness. And any sort of direction that hides transparency and doesn't educate the public is where we have the corruption and legal theft that's been going on since the Reagan deregulation following the savings and loan.
What do you know about it, Joe? What do you know about it?
I spent 15 years in New York City serving the people, the Wall Street community. I moved to New York following rent control, if you will, deregulation. And we saw an epic gain of wealth amongst New Yorkers and elite bankers and the Goldman Sachs. And it's sad because people, again, want transparency. They want openness and honesty.
I entirely agree. And that's why it's important to have simple methods such as raise the minimum ratio of the book value of equity relative to the book value of assets and also maintain transparent cash reserves. This is going to prevent these banks going bust. It is a transparent measure. And many of the provisions put in by Dodd-Frank are not transparent and can be gamed.
Scott in Raleigh, North Carolina. Scott, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have so many things I want to talk about with this issue. But first of all, I think that the fiduciary clause, and I'm not sure of all the details, should be revisited, but to include everybody, including stockbrokers, who have anything to do with the personal finances of individuals.
Put the investor's interest first. Okay, why? What, Scott?
Exactly. Why? Because I was a victim quickly. I called my stockbroker to execute a trade, and he talked me out of it because of some stockbroker jargon, and it cost me somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000 of paper profits that I would have realized had he executed those two deals. I'm still
the fiduciary rule wouldn't have stopped.
The day I die.
The fiduciary rule would not have stopped that, unfortunately.
Scott, are you sure the fiduciary rule would have helped you out there? Are you sure?
Well, because he wasn't doing anything in the best of interest. I had a margin account, and I was going to clear out my margin account, and I would have been completely out of debt.
Yeah, Jared, I hear you there. What do you say, Jared?
So the way the fiduciary rule is set up, it really only applies to people getting advice on retirement savings. So actually, Scott's right in the sense that the rule would have to be applied to other people giving financial advice. But I think we have to be mindful here. The fiduciary rule doesn't say you can't lose money in the stock market. It says that what brokers and financial advisors have to do is act in your best interest. And that means that they can't advise you on products that hurt your return over the longer run while boosting their own profits. It doesn't mean that they can't put you into risky products. This is something I think Diana was getting wrong earlier. If that's your preference, if you want an actively managed portfolio, one that goes into the stock market, and you're very clear that that's what you want, it's no conflict of interest for a broker to deliver that to you. But too many times, brokers are advising clients on profits that actually hurt their long-term returns so that the broker themselves can get a bigger paycheck.
Jared, what's the point, if I may, the time is short, and I want to ask about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. What is the point of going after that, to either change the way it's run or just plain go at it? Jared, what's going on there?
That's just really very simple. Unfortunately, it's to allow financial institutions to rip consumers off in a way that they were doing before. Now, you have to recognize that since it's been in place, the Consumer Bureau has paid off $12 billion in folks just like the Wells Fargo people who fell victim to the plot that Steve talked about earlier. So I just think taking this down is complete hypocrisy from a Trump claim that he's actually helping the people who helped get him to where he is today.
Take that down and be for the little guy, Diana, really?
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has the power to go into any company in the United States and take it over on the grounds that it's too big to fail. That is too much power for one group. And the head of it, Richard Cordray, was recently ruled as having his position in an illegal way, according to a judge.
But what if they are too big to fail and it puts the economy at risk and the little guy pays again?
You cannot have a government agency being able to go to any company and say, we're going to take it over. We have a market mechanism and we have investors. If a company is not doing a good job, then it loses investment, it loses products.
But that didn't work in 2007-8. That did not work. Steve Leisman, this can sound like a three-card Monte game to a little guy, you know, like to me. There's all these different pieces to it. How do we know if it ends up favoring the ordinary American that Donald Trump pledged on the campaign trail to champion?
It's a tough one to know. Ultimately, you want to see how the market behaves the next time there is a financial crisis and whether or not ultimately the rules were put in place that really does what we should not lose sight of.
That's a terrible way to measure, Steve. We have to go through another crisis to see if it worked or not.
Hey, if you put my two recommendations in place, then we're
not going to
have
another way.
I think a collapse of the banking system.
There is one thing I do want to discuss, though, which is the international aspect of this very quickly, which is the United States has led the world towards stronger capital standards around the world. It worries me that loosening them here at home will cause others abroad to loosen them. And then what you have is a global race to the bottom when it comes to capital standards. And I would like to see the Trump administration affirm its desire to keep stewarding the world when it comes to banking regulations.
Let's hope we don't go back to all that. Steve Leisman with CNBC. Thank you so much for being with us today, Steve.
My pleasure.
Diana Furstgott-Roth at the Manhattan Institute. Thank you, Diana.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And Jared Bernstein at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Jared, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.